18. The Sixth Disinformation Operation, the alleged recurrence of power struggles in the Soviet, Chinese, and other parties. The West has been seeing evidence since the early 1960s of recurrent power struggles in the leadership of the Soviet, Chinese, Yugoslav, Czechoslovak, and other parties. In the Soviet Union, it has been seen in the alleged dismissal of Khrushchev in October 1964 for his policy failures and adventurism in the alleged power struggle between the moderate and Stalinist factions that followed his dismissal. In Brezhnev's switch to neo-Stalinist practices since 1968 and in opposition to him from the liberals in the Soviet leadership. In China, it has been seen in the alleged struggle for power between the militant, radical, Stalinist, Maoist faction, Mao, Lin Piao, Chen Prata, and the moderate, pragmatist faction, Chou Enlai, Teng Xiaopingji, Ping Teihui, Ping Chen, Lu Xiaotsi, Lo Jitsin, in the dismissal of Teng Xiaopingji, Ping Teihui, Lu Xiaoqi, Ping Chen, and others, in the alleged cult of Mao, an unexplained phenomena in China, such as the activity of the Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution, and in the reemergence of pragmatists like Teng Xiaoping since Mao's death in 1976. In Yugoslavia, it has been seen in the alleged power struggle between Tito and his deputy premier and minister of the interior, Rankovic, which resulted in the ousting of Rankovic in 1966. In Czechoslovakia, it has been seen in the struggle between the conservative Novotny faction and the liberal Dubček faction, which resulted in the victory of the liberals and the alleged dismissal of Novotny in 1968. In order to demonstrate that this semblance of recurrent power struggles is a misrepresentation of the facts directed principally at Western observers and intended to serve communist strategic purposes, the developments in these struggles in the Soviet Union and elsewhere must be examined in the light of both official and inside information about them. Succession in the Soviet leadership, new stabilizing factors. The problem of succession in the leadership of the Soviet Union and other communist countries is of great importance, since on it depends the solution of many other practical problems. The question that has to be answered is whether or not a one-party, communist, dictatorial system can settle the problem of succession without recourse to a struggle for power, as has happened in the past. Another related question is whether Khrushchev was forcibly removed in 1964 or whether, on the contrary, he succeeded in transferring his power and solving the succession problem without a crisis. Most non-communist observers are inclined to regard communist parties as incapable of finding a solution. They think that the recurrence of power struggles is inevitable. The most dramatic confirmation of this view was the allegedly forcible removal of Khrushchev from the Soviet leadership in 1964.1. The present study will attempt to distinguish between the facts surrounding Khrushchev's departure from office, the deliberate misrepresentation of them by the Soviet strategists, and the unfortunately erroneous interpretation of them by reputable Western scholars. In order to make the distinctions clear and to explain how and why the facts were misrepresented by the Soviet strategists and why reputable Western scholars continue to accept uncritically information on the continuing existence of power struggles, it is helpful to compare the succession situations of 1924 and 1953 with the events of 1960-64, using for the purpose official information as well as inside knowledge and the new methodology. The failure of Lenin and Stalin to solve the succession problem. There are similarities between the situations in 1924 and 1953. Lenin's death in January 1924 left a political vacuum. There was no single recognized successor with a ready-made team of supporters. Instead, there were several rival leaders, each with his own claim on power. The situation in the country was still critical. Lenin's adopted policy, the NEP, was still in force, but many practical problems within that policy awaited their solutions. Stalin's death in March 1953 left an even greater political vacuum. The dictator left no designated heir, nor was there a single recognized successor with a supporting team, as in 1924, there were several leaders with rival claims on power. There was a critical situation in the Soviet Union and in other communist countries. No long-range policy had been adopted despite the need for long-term solutions to the crisis in the bloc. All these circumstances invited succession crises. Power struggles were inevitable in both cases because of the rivalries among the new groups of leaders. The membership of the new generation in each case was fortuitous, unstable, and divided, its individual members ambitious to play a leading role and at the same time faced with the necessity of formulating a policy for the party. The critical situation in the Soviet Union in 1924 and in the bloc as a whole after 1953 demanded new solutions to burning issues. The struggle for power became at the same time a struggle for policy, which added to its bitterness. In each case, the struggle ended with the elimination from political life of all but one of the contenders. Lenin's death was not unexpected, in view of his long illness. The struggle for power began while he was still alive. Stalin took the opportunity to strengthen his position to some extent even before Lenin's death. In 1924, there was still an atmosphere of inter-party democracy. The party rank and file, as well as the party and government apparatus, participated in the struggle and exerted some influence over it, which explains why the struggle after 1924 lasted longer than that after 1953. Lenin revealed his concern about the succession in letters to the Party Congress, written in December 1922 and January 1923, in which he warned against the concentration of too much power in Stalin's hands. He also warned against the possibility of a split in the leadership and the need to prevent conflicts between small central committee groupings, which would gravely affect the fate of the party as a whole. He advocated a dispersal of his powers not to a few leaders, but rather to an enlarged central committee with enhanced authority, whose membership should be increased from 27 to as many as 100 members. Point 2 of necessity. Some dispersal of power did occur. Lenin's personal rule was followed for a few years by an oligarchic rule. But there were no constitutional means of deciding the succession and no provision for popular participation in the process. The problem was one for the leader of the party himself to solve. Only the leader had the authority to put his recommendations into effect. The difficulty was that, although Lenin gave a theoretical solution to the succession problem, he did not solve it in practice because of his illness. Moreover, although he was worried about a split in the leadership after his death, he himself invited a power struggle in his ambiguous testament, in which he did not indicate who should be his successor. Had he not been ill, he could have made his testament effective. In the event, it was not fulfilled after his death. Partly because Stalin needed time to take control over the government apparatus, the struggle after Lenin's death lasted until the mid-1930s, by which time all Stalin's rivals and real or possible opponents and even some of his supporters had been eliminated physically. Not infrequently, Stalin adopted the policies of his victims. The emphasis on physical elimination was not irrational. Because the whole party apparatus was involved in the struggle and because some vestiges of inter-party democracy survived, he was obliged when removing leaders to purge all of their supporters from the party by mass repressions to forestall possible opposition from them. He dispensed with collective leadership and established his own total, personal dictatorship. This was a backward step, which weakened the communist system and gave rise to the succession crisis and many other problems. After the physical elimination of his rivals and the mass repressions of their followers, he could no longer rely on his colleagues or the party, but only on the security bureaucracy. He ruled by watching potential rivals, dividing them, and exploiting one against the other. By eliminating Zhdanov, the most promising of his possible successors, he invited a crisis in the succession. Up to his last days, he ignored the problem. And his negligence left a vacuum after his sudden death that further contributed to the intensity of the ensuing struggle. Point 3. Stalin's rigid personal dictatorship and his destruction of inter-party democracy meant that the party membership was not involved in the power struggle after his death. It took place only in the upper reaches of the party and government hierarchy. In 1953, the bureaucracy would have been prepared to serve any leader who was capable of taking control over it. Unable to appeal directly to the party or the people, the bureaucrats had become nobodies in Stalin's final years. For these reasons, the struggle after his death was relatively short and was not accompanied by mass repressions, except in the case of Beria's supporters. There were similarities and differences between Stalin and Khrushchev. Like Stalin, Khrushchev, after the removal of Malenkov in 1955, began as a communist dictator. He established his preeminence in 1956-57, using non-constitutional means and tactics, and wielded his power, though not for long, in dictatorial fashion. From 1956 to 1959, he replaced Stalin's cult of personality with one of his own. The darker side of Khrushchev's career is still kept hidden from the public by the Soviet leaders. Unlike Stalin, Khrushchev did not physically eliminate his rivals, apart from Beria. Since they had no followings, it was unnecessary. Unlike Stalin, Khrushchev, though he remained supreme, managed to establish collective leadership during his final years in power. But the most important difference between him and Stalin was that he succeeded in accomplishing the transfer of power to a successor he had chosen. The view that he shared Stalin's disregard for the succession problem is erroneous. Like Lenin, he was concerned about it. Moreover, according to the present analysis, he found what Lenin tried but failed to find, a practical solution to the problem. Probably with the help of Mao's influence, he solved it on the lines of Lenin's recommendations and by committing his followers to a long-range policy for the whole communist bloc. And in so doing, he established the model for the leaders of other communist states to follow. Khrushchev's removal and agreed transfer of the leadership to Brezhnev. The view that Khrushchev was removed in a palace revolt is probably mistaken. It is not supported by the available evidence. In 1964, the situation differed radically from that in 1924 or 1953. After Khrushchev's departure from the leadership, there was no political vacuum. The same united team of active Khrushchev supporters carried on. The internal crisis of the regime and the problems of intra-bloc relations had been solved. The long-range policy for the whole bloc had been adopted and was in operation. There were no grounds for expecting political crisis or power struggle. The tragic consequences of the two previous succession crises were not lost on Khrushchev and the other Soviet leaders. Lenin's death had been followed by the liquidation of a generation of party leaders, by mass repressions in the party, and by splits in the Communist International and its affiliates. The struggle after Stalin's death had delayed the formulation of a long-range policy and threatened the continued existence of the communist bloc. It was vital that there should be no further repetition of these disasters. In 1964, favorable conditions existed for a calculated transfer of power by Khrushchev to a leader or group of leaders of his choice because of the existence of collective leadership, as practiced under Khrushchev since 1959. The increased influence of the Central Committee and party apparatus, the absence of opposition in the leadership, the greater stability of the regime, improved relations with the leaders of other communist countries. The establishment of collective leadership in the Chinese Party under Mao, and, above all, the adoption of the long-range policy. Khrushchev had a personal interest in the implementation of this policy through his successors because it was adopted during his rule and with his active participation. His role in its initiation offered him promise of greater posthumous respect and recognition than Stalin had been accorded for all the power and glory of his reign. In his concern for long-range policy, Khrushchev would naturally have considered the question of succession. He was in a perfect position to arrange it, since he controlled the situation in the party and the government, and he had time in which to act. He had packed the Presidium and the Central Committee with his men. He had his nominees in the KGB and the army, and at key points in the party and government apparatus, he retained his own leading position in the party secretariat, the Presidium, and the government. In the light of his claims to be another Lenin, it seems likely that he gave serious thought to the problem, as Lenin did in 1922-23. Following Lenin's example, he probably made recommendations to the Central Committee in the form of secret letters or speeches on the eve of the 22nd Party Congress. Such indications as there are support the conclusion that he was thinking about and acting on the succession problem on the eve of his removal. Signs of this can be detected from the 22nd Party Congress in October 1961 onward. Speaking about Lenin's advice on the cult of personality, he called on the party to be worthy pupils of Lenin in this matter. Point 4, he confirmed Stalin's mistakes and warned about the consequences of the cult of personality for leaders who forget their duties to the party. Point 5, according to his definition, the chief evil of the cult of personality lay in the leaders being outside the control of the party. Point 6, he claimed that collective leadership had been achieved and asked that his own personal role should not be emphasized. Point 7, the new party statutes adopted at the Congress provide that at every regular election of the CPSU Central Committee and Presidium, not less than one quarter of the members must be new. Of the Central Committees of the Republic parties, not less than one third must be new. And of committees of other party organizations, not less than one half. The alleged purpose of these reforms was to foster inter-party democracy. The new regulations and other decisions of the Congress, which were complied with thereafter, were defined by Khrushchev as guarantees against recurrence of the cult of personality. Point 8, at the same time, the Soviet party press recalled a quotation from Lenin stating that the revolutionary movement cannot be stable without an organization which maintains the succession of leaders. Two other significant decisions of the 22nd Congress were obviously modeled on Lenin's recommendations, namely, The increase in the membership of the Central Committee in comparison with the 21st Congress from 125 to 175 members and the transfer from the Presidium of Ignatov, Furtseva, Mikitinov, Belayev, and Aristov, and their replacement by new party activists in accordance with the statutes. Point 9 in the author's view, Khrushchev's was a short-term personal dictatorship which was replaced, wisely and in time, by collective leadership in order to avoid a succession crisis and a further struggle for power. Various new circumstances contributed toward and conditioned the reorganization of the system. They were the condemnation of Stalin's cult of personality and the practice of physically eliminating rivals, the incompatibility between personal dictatorship and the active, constructive, and harmonious collaboration of a bloc of communist countries in pursuit of a common long-range policy, Mao's voluntary and exemplary decision in 1959 to give up all his positions of power except the leadership of the party in order to concentrate on problems of long-range policy and communist strategy, the concern of the bloc leaders as a whole to avoid a repetition of the painful events after 1924 and 1953, the personal interest of Khrushchev and Mao in avoiding subsequent condemnation of their activities resulting from a further power struggle, and hence their willingness to yield power voluntarily to the party apparatus and bureaucracy, the stabilizing effect of the long-range bloc policy. Given past experience, given the establishment of collective leadership, and given these new circumstances, the bloc's leaders had already begun by 1960 to make advance arrangements within their central committees to ensure a smooth, timely, and peaceful transfer of power, as was the case, in the author's view, with the succession to Khrushchev in 1964. The Western version of Khrushchev's removal was based on inadequate and unreliable evidence. The main items taken into account were that Khrushchev was given no recognition for his services, his portraits disappeared in Moscow, his son-in-law and associate in policy, Adzubi, was dismissed. It became known later that he had been demoted to a less important position in a Soviet newspaper. References appeared in the Soviet press to the cult of personality, which, though they did not directly mention Khrushchev's name, were interpreted in the West as a campaign of de-Khrushchevization. Khrushchev was allegedly living in humble obscurity with a small retinue of servants. According to unconfirmed reports, he was dismissed for nepotism at the end of an 8-hour meeting of the Presidium on the strength of a report by Suslov. He was responsible for numerous policy mistakes and failures, such as the withdrawal from Cuba, the begging of wheat from the United States, the quarrel with China, the ill-conceived decentralization of the Soviet economy, his proposed visit to West Germany, and his unsuccessful personal style of diplomacy with its mixture of insults to and cajolery of the West. This evidence is unconvincing and contradictory. The first argument against Khrushchev's having been forcibly removed is the fact that it was his team that continued, without significant changes, to dominate the Soviet leadership. Brezhnev, who replaced him as the party leader, was his most trusted, obedient, and experienced assistant, friend, and colleague. He owed his career to Khrushchev and was a link between the Ukrainian and the Moscow party groups. Kirilenko and the former president, Podgorny, were almost as close to Khrushchev as Brezhnev. Other faithful lieutenants and appointees of Khrushchev, like Shelepin, Biryuzov, Malinovsky, Semichastny, and Patalishev, retained their key positions in the party and the government. Even more important, two of Khrushchev's relatives continued to hold power in the leadership and government. One of them was even promoted later on. The two were Polyansky, who stayed on as a member of the Presidium and Premier of the Russian Republic, and Marshal Grechko, who remained as first assistant of the Minister of Defense and chief of the Warsaw Pact forces. A few years later, he was promoted to the major post of Minister of Defense. Point 10. The fact that Khrushchev's relatives retained their key positions after his departure is inconsistent with Western belief in a palace revolution and Khrushchev's abrupt dismissal. It supports the conclusion that it was a smooth and agreed transfer of power. Furthermore, it disposes of the story that Khrushchev was dismissed for nepotism, because his relatives, apart from Adzubi, were not affected by his loss of office. Here it is important to point out that the relationship of Grechko and Polyansky to Khrushchev has never been publicly revealed by Brezhnev or other party leaders. Such information is normally kept secret and is known to very few within the party. If Khrushchev had in reality been dismissed for his cult of personality or his policy mistakes, open criticism of him could have been expected in the communist press. In fact, there was very little, and such as there was oblique and indirect. There were no revelations about his complicity in Stalin's crimes or about the ruthlessness of his struggle for power in 1955-57. There was no criticism of his adventurous foreign policy over the Berlin and Cuban crises or of his exploitation of Soviet writers. There was some vague criticism in the Soviet press about cult of personality and other rather minor aspects of policy, which was interpreted by Western journalists as referring to Khrushchev. Perhaps this interpretation was supported by revelations of communist officials to their Western contacts, but communists do not normally give Western diplomats or journalists the true facts of the case. There was some speculative reporting about Khrushchev's private life, his hunting, his apartments, and his villas, and there was his sensational appearance before Western journalists. Such manifestations should not be accepted at face value. They can be better understood in the context of bloc disinformation operations. Naturally, there was no official recognition of Khrushchev's services to the Soviet Union, because that would have upset bloc disinformation about the recurrence of power struggles. To sum up, there was no major convulsion before or after Khrushchev's retirement. With few exceptions, there was continuity in the leadership. Above all, there was continuity in the implementation of the long-range policy that Khrushchev had initiated. The most likely explanation, therefore, is that Khrushchev's removal was a staged affair conducted with his full agreement. Furthermore, it was probably staged with the foreknowledge and agreement of the communist leaders of other countries. This would explain the well-publicized visits of Western communist leaders to Moscow after the dismissal to demand explanations for it and to express their high regard for Khrushchev and his policies, thereby demonstrating to the West their newly won independence of the Soviet Union. Over the radio, in their newspapers, and in official documents, the Russian people were told that Khrushchev had resigned on grounds of age and failing health. He was born in 1894. The official version could well be near the truth. Lenin had set a precedent for retirement on grounds of health. Khrushchev wanted to go down in history as another Lenin. Like Lenin, he even went hunting in the neighborhood of Moscow after his retirement. In spite of his Stalinist background, he had made a significant contribution to the communist cause, but this contribution could not be given immediate public recognition for tactical considerations. In due course, probably after the conclusion of the long-range policy, tribute will be paid to all the leaders who were responsible for the policy, including Khrushchev, Mao, Novotny, Ulbricht, Tito, Brezhnev, Deng Xiaoping, and many others. Khrushchev would not have been a true communist if he had not agreed to such an arrangement, and no doubt he did so with his usual mocking humor. It is interesting that Nizhvestny, the controversial sculptor whom Khrushchev had himself criticized for abstractionism, was allowed by Soviet officialdom to design the symbolic black and white monument on Khrushchev's grave. Not many years after his death, Khrushchev's name began to reappear in the Great Soviet Encyclopedia. According to the present, new interpretation, Khrushchev's retirement, which incidentally enabled him to write his memoirs, was intended to solve the problem of succession in the Soviet Union, to rehearse the changing of the guard in accordance with his wishes, and to forestall upheavals and difficulties for the party, for the regime, and even for himself. A smooth, agreed-upon transfer of power was rendered possible by, and in itself served to guarantee, the continuity of long-range bloc policy and strategy. The new guard came from the old team of leaders committed to the same policy. Since all the leaders of the communist bloc were and are equally committed to it, none can change it arbitrarily, whether in the Soviet Union, China, Romania, or any other communist country, without facing serious opposition from the party apparatus in his own and other communist parties. Since Khrushchev's retirement was probably agreed with the leaders of the other parties, it can also be suggested that his example was followed, with local variations, in the transitions from George Dej to Ceausescu in Romania, from Novotny to Dubček to Husak in Czechoslovakia, from Gomulka to Jirek to Kania in Poland, and from Ulbricht to Honecker in East Germany, and in the transitions in China and Yugoslavia that followed Mao's and Tito's deaths. According to this analysis, Khrushchev's retirement was a successful fulfillment of Leninist ideas on the transfer of power between leaders. Since there is no solid foundation for the belief that Khrushchev was removed by power struggle, the conclusion can be drawn that, for strategic reasons, his retirement was deliberately misrepresented, partly to the inhabitants of the communist countries but mainly to the West, as part of a succession crisis analogous to those that followed Lenin's and Stalin's deaths. Similar conclusions can be drawn from so-called power struggles in the Yugoslav, Chinese, Czechoslovak, and Polish parties. In fact, all of them should be regarded as operations within the framework of the Bloc Disinformation Program. Objectives of disinformation on power struggles. The disinformation effort to keep alive Western belief in the existence and inevitability of recurrent power struggles in the leadership of communist parties serves several purposes. There is an obvious close connection between power struggles and factionalism. Neither exists without the other. Disinformation on power struggles therefore supports and complements disinformation operations based on spurious factionalism, such as those on de-Stalinization, the Soviet-Albanian and Sino-Soviet splits, and democratization in Czechoslovakia in 1968. It further serves to obscure the unity, coordination, and continuity within the bloc in pursuit of an agreed long-range policy. By creating false associations in Western minds between different communist leaders and different aspects or phases of communist policy, Khrushchev with revisionism, Mao with dogmatism, Teng Xiaoping with pragmatism, Dubček with democratization, and Brezhnev with neo-Stalinism, the West can be induced to make false deductions about the mainsprings of communist policy, inaccurate predictions about its future course, and mistakes in its own responses. The West is more likely to make concessions, for example, over SALT negotiations, or the supply of high-technology goods to the Soviet Union or China, if it believes that by so doing it will strengthen the hand of a liberal or pragmatic tendency or faction within the party leadership. Conversely, the West can be persuaded to attribute aggressive aspects of communist policy to the influence of hardliners in the leadership. The disappearance from the scene of leaders thus identified can be used to promote the myth of liberalization, as was done in the case of Novotny in Czechoslovakia in 1968. Part 3 will argue that similar developments may be expected in the Soviet Union and elsewhere in Eastern Europe in the final phase of long-range policy, and that the succession to Brezhnev may well be exploited for the same purpose. One further possible purpose of spurious power struggles may be suggested, that the purging or disgrace of leading communists such as Teng Xiaoping in China or Barak in Czechoslovakia, who disappeared for varying periods of time allegedly as the victims of a power struggle, may be intended to cover up their secondment to serve during their disappearance in a secret policy coordinating center somewhere in the bloc.